This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's sure smoky in Minnesota today.
Those aren't clouds. That's Canadian smoke.
That smoke rising from wildfires burning more than a million acres across several Canadian provinces, some for weeks now.
Have we already passed the point of no return for polar glaciers? Sea level rise redraws the map of the world. Explore with top glaciologist Dr. Chris Stokes from Durham University in the UK. But first, Canadian fire expert Michael Flanagan reports on the latest giant outbreaks in the north. Tens of thousands were evacuated. Unhealthy smoke is covering Canada, the U.S. Midwest, New York to Georgia, reaching Greece and Ireland. We are living in the climate future already.
Fires raging in Saskatchewan forced more communities to evacuate over the weekend.
This morning, some of the nation's midsection tinted with a milky haze as wildfires burn out of control in Canada, smoke being blown across the border for days.
Tonight, airlifted to safety, the relief and frustration as more Canadians flee wildfires.
It's very hard and tiring and scary.
Stranded for days, their community cut off. Some evacuees escape to find hotels at capacity.
Canadian wildfires are back, starting early. The 2023 wildfire season in Canada burned an estimated 18.4 million hectares of land, over seven times the annual average. The majority of people in the Northwest Territories were evacuated. It was a gruesome year. Now the blazing nightmare is burning across northern Canada again. Unhealthy smoke already drifted down into the Midwest states, New York, and as far south as Georgia. Is this the new normal in the age of climate change? I think the best expert on Canadian wildfires is Dr. Michael Flanagan. After a distinguished career at the University of Alberta, Mike is now British Columbia Research Chair in Predictive Services, Emergency Management, and Fire Science at Thompson Rivers University. He is author or co-author on hundreds of peer-reviewed papers on forest fires. Mike Flanagan, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you, Alex.
Did the 2025 fire season start earlier than in 2023?
Actually, no. It didn't start. 2023 is exceptional, off-the-charts, record-smashing year. This year started early, it's very active, and only 2025 had more area burned at this point in time and had a faster start.
And you're in northern British Columbia, I believe. Are you already seeing fires there?
So I'm actually in south central British Columbia, Kamloops, on the Thompson River. The northeast is on fire, and northern Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Northwestern Ontario. That's the corridor. About 2.2 million hectares has burned at this point, which is about the size of New Jersey.
Given your long career of fire watching, what do you find noteworthy about the Canadian wildfires so far?
Well, it started fairly normal. Once the snow goes, much of Canada sees snow during the winter. And until the vegetation flushes, the grass turns green and leaves come out, there's a window of opportunity for fire because you still have a lot of dead organic material. And most of the fires that time of year are human caused because our lightning season is just kicking into gear now. And, you know, about half of our fires are human caused, half are lightning caused, but human caused dominate in the spring. Lightning dominates in the summer. Then we had some heat and temperatures near 100 degrees Fahrenheit in southern Manitoba. And we had a rash of fires and, unfortunately, a couple fatalities, which is really unusual for civilian fatalities to happen in Canada. And then we had a real episode the last couple of weeks where it's been hot, dry, and windy, and then we got some lightning starts, and now we're on fire. And the smoke has gone to Florida, it's gone to the Mediterranean, and these fires will burn through the summer. These are huge fires. And unless we see torrential rains or Herculean efforts by fire management, these fires will burn all summer. And every time we get some wind, they'll grow and produce smoke. And who knows where it's going to end up? I can almost guarantee you it won't be another 2023. But it will be a very active fire season. We're already, you know, halfway to our normal annual area burned, and it's only early June. So expect this to continue. The seasonal forecast, which you do have to take with some salt, or perhaps a lot of salt, suggests it's going to be hot and dry over much of Canada. So we may see these fires continue, and perhaps fires in other areas that are currently not active.
And we know wildfires can create their own weather systems, including winds and even lightning. Any of that so far this year?
Actually, that's a good point, because this year we've seen more pyro CBs. These are fire-generated thunderstorms than I've seen in any other season to this point. So when you have combustion through a forest fire, it produces heat, obviously, but also a byproduct is moisture. And it's kind of like your grade 3 water cycle. You know, this plume rises, eventually it starts to cool, and then clouds can form, and then you can get a thunderstorm. And with lightning and hail and rain, but the lightning can start new fires. And this has happened on other pyro CBs, fire-generated thunderstorms. We're just seeing fires are more intense than they used to be. And this is a real challenge for fire management, because high-intensity fires like we see with these pyrocumulonimbus are difficult to impossible to extinguish, which means you have to get out of the way. Evacuations, and we've got over 30,000 people evacuated already, and that number is probably going to increase. Number of structures lost is over 400 in Saskatchewan alone. The other option fire management has is to do a burnout operation where you get in front of the wildfire, start a new fire. Yes, you're starting a fire, but it's fighting against the wind. It's backing into the wind, so it's lower intensity and manageable. Eventually, this burnout operation and the wildfire meet, and the wildfire has no more fuel or vegetation to burn, and it can be very effective. We use this tool a lot. As long as the winds aren't shifting, it's a good tool. But when those winds shift, that burnout operation could become another wildfire. Now you're a bigger problem than you were when you started.
Yes, there were about 30,000 people evacuated so far. They've already filled up the larger cities in Manitoba and Saskatchewan. People are being shipped off even to Ontario. And here again, we have a racial justice aspect of climate change too, because the majority of people fleeing their homes are Aboriginal or First Nations people. The hotels have overflowed. Some people are sleeping in arenas waiting for help. I wonder, could the old way of life in the Canadian North be no longer possible in this age of superfires? What do you think, Mike?
So we live in a flammable landscape, for sure. And we're seeing more fire, and we're seeing more intense fire. The area burned in Canada has quadrupled since the 70s, similar to Western United States. You know, I think there is a way forward. There's a program called Fire Smart in Canada, a similar program in the United States called FireWise, and there's principles to help your community and your home be more resilient to fire. We can't make them fireproof, but we can do things to make them more resilient. So I think we can live if we use these fire smart principles, and if we use things like sprinklers can be very effective if fire does come. We can manage fuels around the community, but the challenge there is that the way a fire typically enters a community is through a rain of embers, little burning bits of twigs, bark, sometimes even pine cones. And the wind can carry them, or these pyro CBs can waft them in the air for kilometers, 2 kilometers, sometimes 5. I'm hearing stories from California and Australia, even longer distances. So even if you treat, you know, the vegetation, the forest right beside your community, a burning ember can come from miles or kilometers away, leapfrog over that right into town. And once fire gets in town and starts one structure burning, can burn structure to structure, and you can lose the whole town that way. And that's the challenge. And, you know, so people will continue to live, but yes, fires disproportionately impact Indigenous communities, because there's many Indigenous communities that are remote. Some have no road access, some have one road access. So that's a challenge for evacuation, and that challenge is going to continue. This is our new reality. You know, I don't like the term new normal because it sounds like we're in a steady state or a plateau, and actually we're in a trajectory, you know, Dante's circle of hell. I'm not sure what circle we're on, a third or fourth, but I know the direction we're going. It's getting worse, and we'll continue on that because we live in a warmer world, and a warmer world means more fire.
Let's talk about wildfire smoke. New research, and I see paper after paper on this, shows breathing smoke is more dangerous than we realized. It kills, it can shorten lives, it can worsen other medical conditions. And already smoke from Canadian fires has reached the United States and even into Europe, as you say. You track satellite images. Have you seen anything interesting?
Yeah, smoke can travel long distances, and that's part of the issue, is that if you live in a major metropolitan area, downtown New York, downtown Boston, your place isn't going to burn down because of wildland fire. But the quality of life can be in the tank for weeks. Also, recent research suggests that about 1.5 million people die every year globally due to wildfire smoke. That's an amazing number, and you know, that's really scary. And we're seeing more fire, and we're seeing more smoke in many areas around the world. And you're right, smoke affects IQ, fetus development. The more we know about smoke, the more we see how hazardous it is for human health. And you know, we can do things to protect ourselves. You can buy air purifiers, air filters. You can wear a mask if it's particularly smoky, the N95 mask that we use for COVID were first developed for wildfire smoke. So they are very effective. But it is a problem, and it's only going to get worse.
According to the EU Copernicus satellite monitoring, smoke from the spring 2025 fires in Canada has already reached Europe, and the plume can be seen from Greece to Ireland, but they say there is little health risk at this time because the smoke is too high to breathe. It's just a haze and nice sunsets, I guess. Have you seen studies about intercontinental drift of wildfire smoke?
Just that it exists, and you're right, typically the smoke that reaches Europe and beyond is at higher levels of atmosphere and so doesn't affect the air quality at the surface, unlike what we're seeing in Canada and the United States. Another aspect of smoke, is, especially with those pyrocumulonimbus, is it can be injected into the stratosphere. So fires and our weather's in the troposphere, but if things are intense, it can pump smoke into the stratosphere that can last for weeks, if not months, and just stay trapped up there. So, and that affects our climate in a couple of ways. And the impacts of smoke is an area of study. It's not exactly my area of study. So I want to limit my conversation on this topic.
Experts used to tell us, don't count forest fire carbon in climate, because any carbon will be recaptured when the forests regrow. And years ago, in an interview, you and I talked about regrowth. You told us very intense fires could sterilize the soil, and any place that reburns within 5 years might prevent that forest from coming back due to the whole seeding mechanism. Are you seeing any of those conditions in this year's fires, like reburns or extreme behavior, or is it too soon to tell?
For this year, it's too soon to tell, but we've had a number of bad fire years in the last decade. And colleagues of mine have been doing research on this topic, and they are finding areas that are not regenerating as rapidly or as well as they have in the past. So we are starting to see the impacts of increased fire frequency and intensity. Another aspect about fire is on an upland forest, it's about carbon neutral over a long period of time. Because a fire comes through, you get new growth that absorbs carbon from the atmosphere, and then it burns again. And unless it's the state change from forest to grassland, which is a one-time credit or negative, you know, it's pretty well carbon neutral. However, peatlands, sphagnum mosses, many of these areas have been collecting carbon for thousands of years, so they're a carbon reservoir, legacy carbon, and a fire can eject that into the atmosphere in a matter of days or weeks, and could be a significant source of greenhouse gases. The other role is we have a lot of permafrost in the boreal forest of Canada, Alaska, and Siberia. And when a fire goes through, it changes the albedo and accelerates the thawing of the permafrost, which has hydrates, methane, and as well as we continue to warm, the warmer temperatures are also thawing the permafrost, releasing methane, which, though measured in parts per billion in our atmosphere, are a very effective greenhouse gas, approximately 8 times more effective than carbon dioxide. It's playing a more significant role and is increasing much more rapidly than our carbon dioxide.
I do worry about those peat fires. I remember in 1997-98 when the big peat fires in Indonesia put that country up into one of the world's top polluters for that year and had some effects on the climate, we think. Now, even if regrowth recaptures some carbon, that does take years. Meanwhile, massive wildfires add gigatons more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, affecting all kinds of systems, maybe glacial melt or rainfall. Is the Great Boreal Forest stretching around the world a net sink or source of carbon these days?
So, you know, that's an interesting question because, you know, some of your listeners may remember the Kyoto Protocol. In Canada and Russia argue vigorously for Article 3.4, which would get credit for forest management because our forests, you know, the argument was that forests are absorbing carbon from the atmosphere. But after some analysis by the Canadian Forest Service, they decided that more likely than not, our forests are going to be carbon sources and not sinks. And that turned out to be true because of things like fire and insects. So most years, our forests in Canada are carbon sources and not carbon sinks anymore. As for Alaska and Siberia, I'm not sure if I have those numbers handy, but definitely in Canada, you know, our forests are no longer carbon sinks.
Scientists are talking about seeding the atmosphere with sulfur to reduce solar energy getting to the surface, but that may be small beans compared to the atmospheric changes from these fires. Can we control superfires in the north? Should we?
So there's a couple of things. So a fire in the north, if it threatens the community or critical infrastructure, yes, we should put it out. These fires that end up being huge, they all start as a spark, a lightning strike, a campfire. They all start small. And there is an opportunity to put those fires out while they're small. And sometimes in extreme conditions, that window is small. That's why detection of fires, reporting of those fires is so important. So a decision can be made. So decisions have to be made quickly to say, you know, is this an unwanted fire that we need to put out right away, or is this just Mother Nature doing her thing, and we'll just monitor the situation to make sure that, you know, no communities or critical infrastructure is threatened. So, you know, that's the challenge. But we will continue to see large, intense fires on our landscape. And whether we fight them or not, sometimes we'll be successful. I mean, overall, places in Canada, United States, you know, success rate ranges around 95% of the fires they fight are small. They put them out while they're small. But the 5% that escape or get large are responsible for almost all of the area burned. So the tail wags the dog in terms of the distribution of fire sizes. And typically these happen during extreme periods of hot, dry, windy weather. There's a recipe for wildfire. It's a simple recipe. You need 3 ingredients. Vegetation, we call it fuel. What type, how much, how dry. Ignition, people and lightning. It's about 50-50 in Canada. Not the same in the States. Much more, probably 90% plus are human caused. And hot, dry, windy, extreme weather. Those are the things that drive fire.
Canada has a new government now. If you were to meet up with the new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, what would you be advising when it comes to wildfires in this country?
So what we'd be telling the Prime Minister is that we have to do more with how we deal with fire. And the situation is that currently fire management's the responsibility of landowners. And so there's 10 provinces, two of the three territories, and there's some federal agencies like Parks Canada. But we generally are reactive, okay? We're not proactive. You know, if we have a fire and we're overwhelmed or fires in a region and we call for help, it takes 3 days for that firefighter to get to the fire, and that's 3 days too late sometimes. Our weather forecasts are pretty decent for fire weather, 5-7 days, and when things look extreme and we have models of expecting new fires, we can move resources to those regions to address the unwanted fires. In Canada, we don't have a FEMA-type agency, a Federal Emergency Management Agency. So when we need extra help, we call for help from other provinces or territories or other countries, or we call in the Canadian Armed Forces, the military. But the military doesn't have very much training for fighting fires. They're great for evacuation, but for fighting fires, they're not. So we need a quick deploy, proactive firefighting agency, national, that can move to those locations ahead of time to deal with these surges. You know, there's episodes where things get overwhelmed, but if we move resources ahead of time, crews, helicopters, etc., I think we can reduce the disasters. The cost of disasters is increasing. We're seeing more of them. We had Jasper burn last year, of course, LA fires this year. Fort McMurray in 2016 was the costliest disaster in Canadian history. If we prevent one of those, it more than pays for itself.
It must be a bit strange. I mean, many of the scientists I talk to, their subject areas are disappearing, whether it's insects in the trees or even glaciers. But your field that you've been working in, as far as I know, most of your life, it's increasing, and that's not good. What are your feelings about that?
So the reason we're seeing more attention on fire is because of the impacts. You know, like I can give you, you know, number of fires, area burn statistics, but at the end of the day, it's really about the impacts. And we're seeing, you know, multiple billion-dollar impacts from fires in California, Maui fire, Camp Fire in California, you know, recent Jasper fire in Canada. We're just seeing more and more of these disasters, and it's going to increase. So we're seeing more attention in terms of research, in terms of management, and in terms of the media. Fire, you know, has great pictures, but it's impacting us. And whether, you know, the impact can be direct, your town can burn down from the fire, or from smoke that can travel thousands of miles or kilometers. Or, you know, in the West, we have what's called cascading impacts, where you have a fire in mountainous terrains, and then you get those winter rains and you get debris flows, flooding. And so these impacts have been increasing significantly. I mentioned that area burn Canada has quadrupled since the 1970s. Same with Western United States. And we see catastrophic fires in Australia, Chile, Greece. You know, like, it's just going on. And that's why we're seeing so much more attention on fire.
Mike Flanagan was editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Wildland Fire. He's taken on leadership roles with the U.S. National Assessment on Global Change and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's pretty well known in print, TV, and radio as a go-to expert on wildfires. Michael Flanagan, thank you for spending time again with our listeners.
My pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Three quick things. Last week, the Canadian fire clouds met a 2,000-mile-wide front of Saharan dust with dry air that was covering Cuba, the Caribbean, and most of Florida. Dust plus fire smoke is not good. Two, decades of cleaning up smog for better health is being undone by toxic wildfire smoke in the new fire era. Think about it. You don't have to be in Canada to be part of the Canadian wildfires. Big fires in places no one has ever heard of are becoming a global threat. And finally, as our guest Chris Stokes told me after our upcoming interview, fire ash lands on glaciers, further reducing the reflectivity of Earth. The sun's energy stays on the surface instead of bouncing back towards space. The darker color speeds up glacier melt. This is another way global warming reinforces itself. Heat equals more fires, equals more smoke, equals darkening ice, equals more warming, equals more heat. As polar regions continue to warm, the remaining ice goes gray with ash. Greenland scientist Jason Box has published pictures of that gray landscape instead of the pristine white snow and ice it used to be.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Sea level rise will cause catastrophic inland migration. Even 1.5 degrees C of warming is not safe for glaciers. The new science comes from a team led by Professor Chris Stokes of Durham University in the UK. Dr. Stokes is a glaciologist, publishing for the past 25 years on world glaciers in the distant past and for future warming. He has over 200 research works and many book chapters. From Durham, Chris Stokes, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
How important is sea level rise to the future of humanity and other species?
I often phrase this as an existential threat. You know, this is literally something that will threaten the existence of species and human populations. If you just think about it, about 230 million people live within 1 meter of sea level. Many of our big cities around the world are within a few meters of sea level. Around a billion people live within 10 meters of sea level. So whilst it's increasing at a relatively slow rate at the moment, and you know, for some that will be imperceptible, it really is this, as I said, this existential threat to humanity. And I'm sure we'll come round to it. But how we respond to that is something that is going to be a major challenge for society, for governments, policymakers to negotiate over the coming years.
According to your new paper, the rate of sea level rise per year is accelerating. In fact, the sea is rising three times faster now than during the 1900s. Chris, is this mainly from expansion of the ocean as water heats up, or is it from melting ice?
That's a very good question, because our ability to measure the different kind of what we call components of sea level rise has really improved over the last few decades. Our measurements have become very accurate. Our estimates of what's causing the sea level rise has become more and more accurate. And you're right that in the past, it's been the thermal expansion of the ocean water that has been the dominant contributor. So that's just the fact that, you know, the density of the ocean changes as it warms and heats up and it expands, and that causes sea level rise. But what we now know is that the contribution from melting glaciers and the polar ice caps, or ice sheets as we call them, has now started to dominate. So now for the last few years has seen that what we call the cryosphere contribution from glaciers and ice sheets, that has now overtaken thermal expansion. And in the paper that we've recently published, we showed that actually the contribution from the polar ice caps or ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica has now become the dominant contributor from the cryosphere. So over the last century, it was those small mountain glaciers dotted around the world that melted most rapidly and contributed to sea level rise. But now we're starting to see some very dramatic changes in the polar ice sheets in Greenland and in Antarctica. And that's what's really worrying, and that was the focus of our paper.
And the rate of sea level rise may be as important as the total amount. Why?
Yes, that's a really good point, and one I'd want to stress as well. We often talk about, you know, future projections will say that sea level rise might be 2, 3, 4 meters. But the timescales are vitally important because, you know, if you're going to say that, I don't know, a city, say London, has to adapt to 2 meters of sea level rise, well, if it's got 500 years to do that, then obviously it's going to be easier than if it's got just 100 years or 50 years to do that. So what we do in the paper, and what a lot of scientists would prefer to talk about, is the rate of sea level rise. Now, as you've pointed out there, the rate of sea level rise has increased very rapidly over the last few decades. It's now at about 4.5 millimeters per year. And when you talk in millimeters, I think people's eyes glaze over and they think that's a small number. But if you look at the recent increase or the recent acceleration, and you were to just, you know, not kind of necessarily add to that, but actually just extrapolate that trend through the rest of this century, and you start to hit 6.5 millimeters in the 2050s. But before the end of the century, we hit 10 millimeters per year. So that obviously is centimeter per year. Now, a centimeter per year is 1 meter per century. So there are a generation, our children's generation, if you like, who, when they're in their 80s and 90s, are likely to be experiencing sea level rise that is 10 millimeters per year. And their children are going to have to cope potentially with rates of sea level rise that are 1 meter per century. And one of the things we point out in our research is that once you exceed about 1 centimeter per year, that's when things become really difficult to adapt to. That's where really your simplest and easiest adaptation is simply to move people inland. You cannot really defend against sea level rise that's 1 meter per century.
Yes, we always took that sea level was some sort of stable that we could measure from, and now our grandchildren will always assume that the sea is always rising, and that's going to be a very strange world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, we know from looking at times in the Earth's past that actually sea level has varied quite dramatically. I think one of the really worrying things that the past tells us is that the last time that greenhouse gas contributions, carbon dioxide contributions, for example, were as high as they are today, sea level globally could have been somewhere between 10 and 20 meters higher. So we know that there's been natural climate variations in the past that have been slow, driven by changes in the way that the Earth orbits the sun. But we know that just really small changes in temperature can have a huge effect on sea level, and we've seen that in the past. Now, of course, what we're doing at the moment is we're artificially warming the planet more quickly than it's ever been warmed in the past due to natural variations. And so it's very simple physics and very simple science to infer that actually we are now heading for some quite rapid increases in sea level and sea level rise.
After some reading and interviews, my take is that Greenland glaciers may predominate in sea level rise in the first stages, like coming decades, and then Antarctica. But what does the science say?
Well, you've got a very good understanding there. So when we think about the melting of ice on land, and which will kind of melt first and quickest, and then which will come next, then it's those small mountain glaciers and ice caps that will be first to go. So these are the glaciers in the tropics. You know, we heard earlier in the year that Venezuela, for example, has now lost all of its mountain glaciers. You've got glaciers on every continent, and they're melting very rapidly. But if all of the mountain glaciers around the world, and there are 275,000 of them, I should add, if all of those were to melt overnight, they would only increase sea level by about 32 centimeters. And that's something we could probably cope with and we could probably adapt to. What we're really worried about are the bigger ice sheets, as we call them, as glaciologists call them, in Greenland and in Antarctica. And Greenland, the island, is pretty much covered by a thick ice sheet that locks up about just over seven meters of sea level equivalent. And in Antarctica, we've got an ice sheet that stores somewhere around 58 meters of sea level equivalent. So if you're worried about sea level rise, then you really need to be looking at Greenland and Antarctica. And Antarctica is, you know, it's obviously in the southern hemisphere, it's at the South Pole, it's a huge continent, but it's very, very cold. And so you're right to suggest that Greenland is what we're most worried about. In fact, if we look at our measurements of Greenland, we know it's contributing far more to sea level rise currently than Antarctica. And because it's situated slightly further south, it's almost a mid-latitude ice sheet. And in some ways, you know, it shouldn't really be there, given the warming that we've experienced. But what we're worried about now is that it's going to tip over some threshold and it's going to start melting much more rapidly than it is. But it's dominated the contribution to sea level over Antarctica. Antarctica, we're also very worried about from a slightly different reason. So Greenland gets attacked by both warm atmospheric temperatures and by warm ocean temperatures that melt its floating portions. In Antarctica, we don't see so much atmospheric melting. It's so cold down there. The air is so dry, it's so cold. You don't tend to get too much melting of the ice from above, from atmospheric warming. But what you do get around Antarctica is ocean warming. And we're really quite worried about ocean warming in Antarctica because we're seeing warm ocean currents, what we say intruding, washing up, if you like, underneath the floating parts of Antarctica. And they might trigger some kind of instability on timescales of maybe within this century, but more likely take place next century. So you're absolutely right. It'll be the small mountain glaciers that will go first, and we're seeing them vanish before our eyes at the moment. Then Greenland, which is now undergoing some very dramatic changes. And then the Antarctic contribution to sea level is likely to kick in the next century. But if you've got, at that point, Greenland melting and Antarctica melting, that's when you're hitting those rates of sea level rise that could be in excess of a centimetre per year.
And we've learned a lot more about past climates and ice in recent decades. Can you tell us about possible Earth parallels long ago that help us understand our own climate future?
So one of the things that we've done in our research is we've looked at past warm periods as an analogue for what might happen in the future. And it's actually really worrying. So, for example, the last time the Earth was kind of as warm as present, say between 1 and 1.5 degrees above those pre-industrial temperatures from the 1800s, it's an interglacial period. It's a warm period about 125,000 years ago. We know that temperatures were the same, but actually greenhouse gas concentrations were much, much lower. But if we look at the sea level record from that time, sea levels were somewhere between 2 and 9 meters higher than present. So what that tells us really clearly is that if you warm the Earth by 1 to 1.5 degrees, which is exactly what we're doing, we're at about 1.2 to 1.3 degrees of warming at the moment above pre-industrial, we're committing ourselves to 2 to 9 meters of sea level rise. If we go back to another warm period, if we go back three and a bit million years to the mid-Pliocene, again, temperatures were probably just a bit warmer than present, but carbon dioxide concentrations were 450 parts per million, so a little bit higher than present. So we use that mid-Pliocene warm period as an analogue for where we might be later this century. And that's when we see several metres of sea level rise, 10 to 20 metres, possibly higher than 20 metres of sea level rise at those temperatures and at those greenhouse gas concentrations that we're heading at. So again, these paint a very worrying picture because they say that, you know, if you play around with just a few fractions of a degree or just, you know, a few tens of parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, then you get changes in the polar ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica that lead to multi-meter contributions to sea level rise. So we use those as analogues, and they tell a very clear picture. It's very difficult to see with, you know, any kind of optimism how we're not heading for several meters of sea level rise over the next few centuries. I mean, this has been known for some time. This is in the IPCC reports that have been released, you know, over the last few decades. But I think one of the things that the IPCC reports tended to be in some ways a little bit cautious is they've said, well, we're committed to this sea level rise. We're committed to maybe, I don't know, 5 to 9 meters of sea level rise. But hopefully it will take place over quite slow, adaptable timescales. So maybe 1,000 years timescales. But what we're seeing is such dramatic changes over the last decade or so that we're now thinking that we need to bring forward some of those estimates. And that's where those rates of sea level rise start to become quite worrying. Because I think what we're seeing, what we're observing, is that we're seeing things happen much more dramatically, much more concerningly than perhaps we thought maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years ago would happen. The pace of change has really accelerated in the last few decades.
Go back 25 years, scientists were not terribly worried about ice loss and sea level rise from massive East Antarctica. Sea ice was growing there, snow was accumulating, it was very cold. Should we reevaluate that?
Absolutely. You know, we call East Antarctica the sleeping giant. I mentioned that in Antarctica, it's the biggest ice mass on Earth. It stores about 58 meters of sea level equivalent volume, but the vast majority of that, you know, 52 meters of that, is actually locked up in East Antarctica. All of the changes we're seeing at the moment are from West Antarctica, and that in itself is worrying because West Antarctica could contribute somewhere of the order of, you know, 4 to 5 meters of sea level rise. But from a sea level perspective, if you're really interested in what the worst case scenario might be, it would be if we start to see mass change from East Antarctica. And I, you know, you can dig back into some of the older literature, some of the papers that were published in the 1980s and 1990s. There are papers out there saying it would take 17 degrees of warming to destabilize East Antarctica. And there are papers out there, as you've alluded to, that showed that East Antarctica was gaining mass, that, you know, it's probably mitigated sea level rise over the last century, because in a warmer atmosphere, we get more snowfall over East Antarctica. So it's ironic that some of the climate skeptics out there would often point to the fact that East Antarctica was growing, therefore climate change couldn't be happening. Actually, it was the opposite. East Antarctica was growing because climate change was happening, because of a warmer atmosphere, we were seeing increased snowfall, increased precipitation over East Antarctica. Now, one of the things that we've discovered over the last one or two decades is that actually, whilst there are still parts of East Antarctica that are gaining mass through enhanced snowfall, we're also starting to see warning signs of ice loss in East Antarctica. And we never thought we'd see this, you know, or at least, you know, going back 20 years or so, we would have been very surprised to see this. But we're seeing subtle changes in East Antarctica that we were seeing in West Antarctica 20, 25 years ago. So this is why we're worried, because at the moment, East Antarctica is kind of in balance. It's not contributing to sea level rise. Parts of it are gaining mass, parts of it are losing mass. But those parts that are losing mass are doing so through the same mechanisms that we've seen in West Antarctica. So, for example, we're seeing the ocean warming around East Antarctica. We're seeing the retreat of glaciers in East Antarctica linked or in the same locations as to where we're seeing the ocean warming. So we're inferring that the same changes that have been taking place in West Antarctica perhaps over the last two decades are just starting to emerge in parts of East Antarctica. And so we need to keep a really close eye on that ice sheet, because if that mass loss starts to outpace the mass gain from the increased snowfall, then, you know, as I said, the sea level potential from East Antarctica is much higher. And some of the, you know, research we've done on East Antarctica and the phrases we've used is that we really don't want to wake up this sleeping giant at the South Pole.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is professor and glaciologist Chris Stokes from Durham University. And now we get to the key message of your latest Nature article. You say 1.5 degrees of warming is not a safe limit, but actually far too high. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this is a tricky one. You know, this is not an easy message to put out there. But, you know, as scientists, we're trained, and part of our job is to tell, you know, the truth, in the sense that, you know, just let the facts, let the observations speak for themselves. So just a little bit of context. If you go back to 2015 and the Conference of the Parties, or the COP at the time, COP21 in Paris, you know, there was a major landmark agreement signed at that COP in Paris in 2015. And that was where pretty much every country in the world signed an agreement to limit warming to 2 degrees above pre-industrial, and ideally to, in the words of that agreement, pursue efforts to limit warming to 1.5. And we're currently somewhere between 1.2 and 1.3 degrees of warming. So we've not got long to go before we hit that kind of, you know, that 1.5 lower limit, ambitious limit within the Paris Climate Agreement. And so there's been huge amounts of research aimed at showing, the advantage of limiting warming to 1.5 rather than 2 degrees or rather than 3 degrees. There's been these calls that you see, we must keep 1.5 alive, we must target 1.5, and that is absolutely something that we're fully supporting. But what the observations show from a sea level rise perspective is that 1.5 seems to be too high. The changes that we're observing, the changes that we think have taken place during past warm periods when Earth was at 1.5 degrees, the changes that are seen to take place when you run your computer models of these ice sheets at 1.5 degrees of warming shows that it will not stop sea level rise. That the best case scenario is that sea level rise will be slow and steady and on this kind of current trajectory that sees us hit 10 millimeters a year of sea level rise before the end of this century. That's the best case scenario. And so this is a bit of an unpalatable message, you might say, whether it's for the public or the policymakers. But what we're saying that is, if you're interested in sea level rise and you're concerned about sea level rise, we thought it was really important that the message gets out there from scientists that 1.5 is not going to solve this problem. That, if we hit 1.5, in the best case scenario, we're still looking at some really dangerous rates of sea level rise. But when we wrote that paper and when we published that message, we didn't want to just stop there. We didn't want to say, well, 1.5 won't be enough. The obvious question, if I was a policymaker and I've attended the last three conferences of the parties or COP meetings, and I do speak to climate negotiators and policymakers, and the obvious question will be, well, okay, if you're saying 1.5 is too high, then what should we aim for? And now that is a really tricky question to answer, because we haven't actually run many computer simulations of Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets at warming levels that are lower than present. But what we do in this paper is we do hypothesize, we think there is enough evidence out there to suggest that actually if you want to protect the ice sheets, if you want to somehow try and preserve the ice sheets and slow or ideally stop sea level rise from Greenland and Antarctica, you probably need to go back to about 1 degree of warming, possibly even lower. So, that you could argue is a conversation for another day, but there is provision within the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. There is provision to review what's called the long-term temperature goal for planet Earth. And so whilst efforts at the moment are very much focused on trying to limit warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial values, to do all we can to do that, to limit the warming, perhaps we're heading for a slight overshoot and then maybe coming back down to 1.5. If there is space in these negotiations to kind of take a kind of broader perspective and say, well, okay, what would be a safe temperature limit for Earth? Then actually I think most of the research, whether you're looking at kind of rainforests, sea level rise, ecosystem change, ocean health, 1 degree or below seems to be a much safer target for planet Earth, I would say. And you know what's really surprising, or perhaps not surprising? People wrote this in 1990s. Yeah, there are papers out there in the 1990s saying, whoa, we think climate warming's happening. A safe limit should be 1 degree. A safe limit for carbon dioxide concentration should be 350 parts per million. And of course, those kind of voices have been largely ignored. And so in some ways, we're just repeating that message that other scientists were pointing out almost three or four decades ago.
I'd like to read you a short quote from a brand new science from David Chandler and his Norwegian colleagues, and then get your take. They say, notably, West Antarctic ice sheet collapse contributes over 4 meters sea level rise in equilibrium ice sheet states with little, 0.25 degrees C, or even no ocean warming above present. Therefore, today we are likely at, or almost at, an overshoot scenario, supporting recent studies warning of substantial irreversible ice loss with little or no further climate warming. Chris, what do you think?
I think there's been a number of similar studies saying this. 10 years ago, there were a couple of papers came out in quick succession using numerical models with some observations showing that actually we may have passed the tipping point for West Antarctica, that we may have already triggered irreversible retreat that will essentially unfold over the next few decades, centuries, scale where the it doesn't matter what we do to the climate, this thing has already now been triggered and there's nothing we can do to stop it. And those were kind of the only two papers, and scientists, I remember them being presented at conferences, and scientists would say, well, you're using a certain setup for your model and certain parameter range, and you know, this is not a unique problem, and you know, other models have since come along and said, okay, maybe we're okay, and then another model will come along and say, no, we've... But I would say that there's now more and more modeling studies creeping out using different model setups, using slightly different forcings and parameter sets that seem to show that this kind of tipping point, if it's not already happened, will certainly be triggered even if we were to magically not warm the Earth anymore. And I think the same is true for Greenland as well. Actually, there are parts of Greenland that seem to have passed a threshold. And so if that is true, we may not know for a few more decades. Scientists might not be able to say with certainty, yes, now we've passed that point of no return, until it is well past its starting point, if you can see what I mean. So I would say there is a growing body of evidence that suggests that actually, even without further warming, the ice sheets in Greenland and West Antarctica are likely to tip into a state of irreversible retreat. And then, of course, our best-case scenario is that it unfolds slowly and steadily and becomes adaptable. Worst-case scenario, we're looking at maybe adding a meter by the end of the century, 2 meters during the next century, which, again, becomes almost impossible to adapt to, and the loss and damage, you know, goes into trillions of dollars.
And as you say, you've attended several climate COPs, the great climate conferences, as an observer, and you sometimes speak directly with national policymakers. Who is most interested in the ice sea level threat, and what do you advise?
Yeah, so it's very simple science, right? You know, the ice melts, the sea level goes up. This is not complicated science, but, you know, I would say that obviously the countries that are most concerned are those where most of their territory is within a few meters of sea level. So you immediately start to think of some of the South Pacific islands, Vanuatu, Tuvalu, the Marshall Islands, you know, those countries where almost their entire landmass is within a few meters and of sea level. And those countries, you know, they could be wiped off the map within a century or two. And that raises all kinds of interesting legal issues, as well as a kind of major humanitarian crisis. Those people will have to move to other territories, and what happens to their state, what happens to their nationality, etc., is a whole kind of legal area that we haven't got time to go into. But then there are other countries as well, you know, which have low-lying areas. You know, Bangladesh, for example, Indonesia, Jakarta, Shanghai in China, Florida in the US, the Netherlands in Europe. You know, almost any country with a coastline is going to be affected by sea level rise. And then you could argue that actually even landlocked countries, they're going to be affected, because we could be looking within a several decades to a century or so, we could be looking at some mass migration, so that even landlocked countries will not be immune from the effects of sea level rise. And so this is something that gains traction at these meetings. You know, people are worried about sea level rise, and it is a scientific area that is used in the negotiations as an example for taking or trying to take urgent action to address, you know, this warming. And our message has always been that, you know, every fraction of a degree matters. So, you know, if we don't make 1.5 and we hit 1.6, well, that will be better than 1.7. Which will be better than 1.9? Which will be better than 2.5? Anything we can do. This is why sometimes I try and move a little bit away from the kind of the tipping points and the temperature thresholds, because we don't know, if we're honest, exactly where they lie. But we do know that, as I said, 1.4 is better than 1.5. 1.5 is better than 1.6. And so we just need to get that message across that, you know, anything we can do to kind of, you know, decarbonize, to reach net zero, where we're not putting as much additional greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, will be helpful and will mean less damage, less loss, less financial outlay in the long term.
We have been speaking with scientist Chris R. Stokes. He is the lead author in the new paper, Warming of 1.5 degrees C is Too High for Polar Ice Sheets. That was published May 20th, 2025 in Communications, Earth, and Environment. This is an open access article. It's free for you to read, and you should. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Whatever circus politics in the stock market provide, wherever you hide in social media distractions or your favorite cable show, there is another reality with physics. Long cycles, the whole biological tapestry. The real world is getting hotter, the sea higher. Fires, flood, drought get more extreme. Does that sound like a cranky Old Testament prophet of doom? Sorry, it is reality, measured by careful minds with a system that controls our delusions as much as we can. It is science, and those are the rocks and the trees and the rivers and the currents of air out there. That is where we are truly alive. I'm Alex Smith. Radio EcoShock is listener-supported radio, and it's now 20 years on the air and not stopping. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Choking in the smoke, put on a mask. Strange, strange, what is it? You don't have to ask when the dragon comes. It's just more fire, thunder in the heat. Another year harder, not much sleep. Hook up the trailer, get out of town. Fire monster coming all around. It wasn't this bad in the old people's day. Kids looking sad, will our home go away? Go ahead, build more pipelines. Go ahead, burn more gas until the dragon comes. To bite you on the bleed. Nothing on the up and up. Safety hard to find. We had a hope, we had a dream. Billionaires ate it all, hid behind the screen.